This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. Episode 37, and the first thing you're going to hear is a chair. That's how it starts. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome. I wasn't to you.
Oh.
That was to whoever's listening. I've seen you for like hours already. Or was to Flapjack, our third guest. He's a guest.
He's a guest
in this house.
Yes.
Welcome
Mr.
back.
Mr. Flapjack Pancake.
Welcome back, bud. He is now 4 months old. He's going to be a terror this entire episode. So any background noise is him. Just so we're clear.
Do people remember he's a dog or no?
No.
Were we just leaving that open to interpretation?
Yeah, he is my four-month-old puppy. He is not a four-month-old actual pancake that I carry around. He's not a security pancake. So he is here. If you hear him, I don't want to hear about it. Enjoy it. He's a sweet puppy. All right.
He is.
We're continuing.
We're here for the exciting conclusion of...
Yeah,
thrilling. Dun, dun, dun.
I'm also now realizing that you haven't set the air conditioner in this room, but let's leave it. Let's just see how this goes.
Let's see how warm it gets in this room before we're done.
Already 75 degrees and only going up, but let's do it. So we have to conclude this. It's more important. Conclude this cliffhanger of a story.
Before it gets too warm in here.
Yeah, please.
To function.
Please.
All right. So last episode, we had started a story that we tend to call the glove story, which was about a real event of a person who was working on an end mill and ended up getting gloved hands caught in the end mill with a serious injury from it. And the reason we were talking about this was this idea of designing differently and trying to make sure that, you know, as we're talking about these hop concepts, that we understand the end goal of what we're trying to accomplish is design that can allow people to be people and absorb variability within the design and not have catastrophic failure, which for me, up until this story, right, this event was very theoretical. I didn't know how to make it actually function within my organization. I understood bits and pieces of it from process safety management, but certainly not when it came to like on the personal or occupational safety aspect of things.
And just to the other part of what you're saying, creating capacity for people to be people as opposed to people being perfect or people being robots, which is what a lot of our systems unfortunately are built off of.
Correct. Of perfection. That was really well said, Matt. I'm going to give you like, I don't know, 3.5 points.
I think I'm at a total of like 7. the ceiling's pretty high that I have to get to. So,
well, you just keep working at it, you know?
keep pressing.
So last episode we had talked about the incident itself and then a little bit about the example of how cars are designed. And what I had shared is that the design of the car being able to fail safely was useful in some regards, because it gave me a mental image of what fail-safe design looked like. But then I was having a really hard time extrapolating those thoughts to my world, because all I was thinking about were the design features itself of like, okay, there's, you know, the airbags and there's crumple zones. And, but like, how would I apply that to anything besides a moving vehicle? I didn't know.
And in this case, an end mill, right?
Right.
So it's like, how do I apply automatic braking, which I guess... Maybe.
I mean, but we could go down that path.
Hold on.
Hold on.
Am I a natural at this? Am I a generational talent at deciding safety solutions?
But yes, I was having a hard time trying to figure out how to apply them. But we did talk about the fact that part of the advantage the automotive industry has is that the designer is also an end user, which allows you to cut through a lot of the bias that exists, right? Hindsight bias after an event, a lot of the oversimplification of how work is being done, and lets you kind of look at work, which in this case would be driving, from a lens that has a lot of the real and raw, like built into how you're seeing the problem set, which is an advantage because then you're also building your solutions around much more realistic, real information in terms of not an idealistic scenario, but a scenario that reflects the reality of driving, of being people, of whatever happens on the road, of the unpredictability of all of it. And so my mission then was to try to figure out how to apply this thought process to the incident that happened with somebody having worn gloves. Just as a reminder, there were two rules that we had in place that were not followed at the moment in time. The first was that the person was wearing gloves on a piece of equipment where we had explicitly stated as a leadership team, you were not to wear gloves on it because of the risk of the glove getting caught. And then also there was guarding in place in order to make it so that the chance of your a hand being exposed to something that was rotating was lower.
And regardless that, if it had a glove or not.
Correct. And that guarding had been removed. And so I had to first get past the feelings of frustration that these rules had been broken in order to get to a place of this idea of once we're at a place of loss of control, now what? Where in this case, the loss of control would be a gloved hand being caught in something that's moving. Right? That's how I would define in this case. It would never be a place we'd intentionally get to. And obviously there were things that were put in place to try to prevent getting there. But once we got to that place, the question was, now what?
And the thought should have been the whole time, I'll just say this, we are going to get to a place where gloves are at that point. That Correct. Is going to happen. Someone's going to have a gloved hand and it's going to touch this equipment.
Yes, that at, if you have enough people around enough things that are moving with gloves somewhere around, eventually those things are going to come together, right?
And we just instead can spend all of our time being like, well, we got to prevent that from happening. We got to create these rules, these guards. Do you imagine you did hand training?
Hand training, absolutely. Yeah. Glove. I mean, we had stand downs around gloves repeatedly and reminders, and we did all of the
things. We don't want that to happen. And the only thing we're going to do is make sure we tell everyone not to do it.
Everyone not to do it. Yeah. So there's nothing wrong with any of these prevention layers, but kind of the first thing that I decided to do after I had my sort of emotional reaction to this and I could gather myself is I wanted to understand how well the preventative measures actually worked, meaning not wearing gloves and having guarding in place. And so I brought some folks together that work with similar types of equipment and I asked them. And I asked them in a way that allowed space for them to tell me bad news without, like, I didn't say, we always wear our gloves, right? Yeah. or can you tell me when we don't wear our gloves? I didn't just say that.
Or like, why on earth would someone wear gloves near this right? equipment?
Would you not wear gloves? Like, especially because people knew that the incident had happened. So hindsight bias is going to tell you that I would never do that, right? And it would be very hard to openly admit that you might wear gloves, especially in the wake of an incident like this. And so the statement I made was something to the effect of, hey, I know that not everything we do, we can do well without wearing gloves. And I also know that we have technically this rule in place where you're not supposed to be wearing gloves around rotating or moving equipment. I imagine that those two things don't always work well together. Can you tell me the places where we kind of really do have to wear gloves, even though we're nearer something that's moving or rotating? So I by asking the question that way, I opened up space to say, it's okay to tell me because I already acknowledge that this is true. Which by the way, I didn't know if it was true. Like I had hoped it wasn't. Like my naive thought process was.
But you just had something happen that told you it probably
correct.
Is true.
Probably is true, right? Probably not the first time, probably not the last time, probably not the only person, right? So, and in that conversation, it became very clear that there were many circumstances in which people wore gloves, even though the rule said not to. And it was because of very logical reasons. Like if I don't wear them, I will be cut. If I don't wear them, this thing is too hot to hold. And I also have to have it in my hands because there's no good tool right now to not have it in my hands in order to do the work I needed to do. So very logical reasons as to why you would choose to wear gloves, even though you're around rotating equipment or moving equipment.
Trade-off.
A trade-off.
Right.
Yeah,
like that's the logic
to get work done. Yep. Right. Because if I don't, then the chance of me getting a sliver of metal in my hand was really high, and it's not a chance I'm willing to take. And so the trade-off is that, hey, I have to be very cognizant of the fact that I'm close to this thing that is moving.
I won't throw us on a curve and yes. say, well, why didn't they just stop work if they couldn't do it? I won't do that.
But I'm sure you're not the only person that would be thinking that. Yeah. So I'm receiving this information, right? And I have to actually not ask the question that you just did in that moment, because in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if a rule doesn't work, we should just stop, right? We should stop and we should redesign. And I can't respond in that moment with that question, because I will just shut everyone down and I won't learn anymore. I started then to realize that there was a laundry list of places in which we were wearing gloves. And then they also taught me about how guarding gets in the way and how often guarding gets in the way, and you can't see through it. And sometimes you have to move it. And if you have to clear chips away, yes, we do move guarding. And then we, you know, clear things away, even if something's moving, because it's just for a second. And then suddenly you're piecing together this reality of, on paper, everything looks perfect and controlled and prevented. And then in reality, that's actually not how work is getting done. And yet this serious incident was an outlier for us, meaning it hadn't happened before in this location. And yet the ingredients for it to happen existed. And so, similar to the idea of, we don't always check our blind spot that we talked about last episode, sometimes by accident and sometimes on purpose. And yet that doesn't conclusively mean we're going to get into an accident every mm-hmm. time, that there's something happening in between. I really wanted to know if there was an in-between, meaning in between the loss of control and the really bad consequence, was there something that was sort of organically happening in between? And sometimes that exists and sometimes it doesn't. And I was just super curious if it existed in this case. So I think the question that I asked at the time was, well, when we are wearing gloves and there is something moving around us, equipment moving or something rotating, or how do we stay safe? Like, how are we not having this type of event happening all the time? And the answers that I got back at first were kind of what I think you'd expect, right? You just have to be really careful, or, you know, you make sure you don't get your hands too close. You create a little bit of separation between what you're doing and the thing that's rotating, or you know, you can't be distracted. Like, those were the answers.
And there are some people, I'm sure, who said, oh, we just don't do that still.
Right. Absolutely. Right? And there are some people that are like, yeah, no, I just don't, I don't do it.
They probably do it.
It could be, right. I don't know. Right. And so although those answers are, you know, helpful to understand, none of them at that point in time felt tangible enough to do anything design-wise, right? It's just, okay, be careful. Well, we know that there's a limit to our ability to be careful. I don't know how to make being careful systemic or useful to everyone else. It's a very individual, you know, risk perception-based activity that, you know, that we can't have full control over all the time. Even the individual doesn't have full control over it.
But couldn't you just get everyone together and tell them to have their mind on task?
I mean, we certainly could have tried that and had done that many times before.
And as someone who has never been in safety, that gets me every time. Gets me every time.
Because it just seems kind of wild to you. Yeah. But for us, it was super normal. And it, you know, I'm sure it still happens in many places. And so originally my thought process was, oh man, like, this isn't useful. Like, it's useful for me to know that there's all these exceptions to these rules that people are trying to manage right now, and we're going to have to spend much more time on this than I thought we were going to. That's useful. But the failing safely part, like, I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board. And my thought process was, it's going to have to be me that figures out how to do it. Which I think honestly was quite egotistical of me at the time to think that I could figure out how to design something differently, even though I wasn't doing the job every day. Like, I have some level of understanding of what people have to do, but certainly I didn't have the nitty gritty details of the end user. And I got lucky that a person actually interrupted that thought process for me, because while everyone else was saying, hey, you just have to be careful, there was one person in the room who had been pretty quiet most of the time. And he did say, jumped into the conversation and he said, well, I do all that, meaning I pay attention, I keep my hands away. He said, but also my grandfather taught me that if you're working around something that is moving or rotating and you have to wear gloves, that you should always cut a slit in the bottom of your glove. And I said, huh? Tell me more. An important side note is that this person is telling me this, knowing that the facility that they're at, it is not allowed to modify PPE. Like, it's a rule not to do it, which means we had to create a safe enough space that people were willing to talk openly for this person to even tell me that this is something that he maybe does or maybe doesn't do at work, as a way to try to mitigate for this loss of control.
And to explain, when you said cut a slit, you're talking about using scissors on the inside part of your wrist going up towards your palm.
Correct.
And cutting a slit that way.
Yes, you got it. And I asked him why. And he said, well, if you have the opening, the bottom of your glove with a wider opening, then if your glove gets caught on something, then chances are higher that the glove will get ripped off your hand rather than your fingers getting ripped off your hand. So the glove will just tear away from your hand.
It's sort of like, this is so bad. I don't know if I should say this. It's sort of like if you grew up and you watched Hulk Hogan.
Yes.
And he would rip off his shirt at the start of every match. He would cut the top and the bottom, so it's much easier to rip off.
Yes.
That's it.
Nailed
safety.
It.
Safety. Got it.
And so this just one statement of something that somebody had been taught by somebody else that had years of expertise, it opened up a larger thought process in my mind on a couple things. One, I wanted to see whether or not these gloves, like, could we modify gloves this way? Do gloves like this exist, right? So that was like the design part of it. But then the other part that it opened up in my mind is, even if that room had not come up with an idea, then maybe we could have crowdsourced ideas from a larger audience, whether it be the wider company or whether it be, you know, an anonymous internet blog. Or blogs were a thing at the time. Are they still a thing? Don't give me that face.
No. Continue. Continue. I don't want to sidetrack us because I could get really dumb.
I realized that still understanding from the end user, even if I hadn't heard a response in that room, was going to be incredibly valuable. And we started to think, and I started to ask the question, well, are there gloves that tear away from your hand? They're designed to do it rather than us trying to create that design in-house. Are they designed to do it? And the answer at this point in time was yes. There was one company that made cut-resistant gloves with tearaway fingers, but it had only been put on the market about 2 years before this event had happened. And the backstory of how those gloves came to exist actually was from another company, which in this case was Ford, and the union, the UAW, had finger amputations because a lot of the work they had to do, you had to use gloves. And there was also equipment that they were using, like torque guns that were rotating. And when you mix those things up, eventually when you do them thousands, millions of times, they come together, and people had finger amputations at multiple locations. And it was their union who thought of the idea of these gloves with tearaway fingers. Based on similar experience of people, you know, having years of experience of wearing gloves around rotating equipment and having that knowledge set, and, you know, somebody's grandfather saying or somebody's father saying you should cut a slit in the bottom of your glove. And at the time that they came up with these concepts, which were, by the way, following down this hop path at the time that they came up with them, the gloves didn't exist. And so they went to a supplier and they said, hey, would you try to create a prototype of cut-resistant gloves with tearaway fingers? And they said no. And then, you know, Ford and the UAW came back and said, we're Ford and the UAW. Would you like to reconsider? Because, you know, we might buy a lot of them, right? Like the underlying piece of it. And they did. They made a prototype. Not only did they make a prototype, but then they tested it for the equipment that Ford was using to make sure that it actually worked and was an effective fail-safe design for what they were doing. this all becomes really important in the mindset and my own acknowledgement of how to design this way in a couple different factors. One was the recognition that still I was not the right person to probably design any of these things. The end user and their experience talking through it, there were a lot of good ideas that were going to come to the table that I would have probably never come up with on my own. But then the second and maybe more important piece of the puzzle was the recognition that the person who's doing the work, who has the lessons from their grandfather to cut the slit in their glove, in an organization is usually not the same person who has the power and authority, the decision rights, the resourcing, and the clout to go to someone like a glove manufacturer and say, can you make this idea something tangible for us? And that all of this design aspect of it was still contingent upon our ability to communicate with each other, which is why I think that there's so much emphasis on the operational learning aspect of what human and organizational performance is because the rest of it doesn't seem to work well without that glue in the middle. So we ended up getting those gloves that existed and testing them out for some of the places that it was really, really hard not to be wearing cut-resistant gloves and do the work. And it's a very different thought process, which we can talk about that at some point, of the idea of even having those gloves for some of us feels scary, right? It feels scary because you are admitting to yourself that that loss of control can happen. And that's even hard to admit. So that's probably a topic for another time.
There's always an interesting part of this conversation where you say, what is the advantage of the car manufacturers is that the designer is the end user. And then we say, we and Hop want the end users to be hard to design. And I imagine there's people out there who think like, yeah, but those designers and the car manufacturers, they went to school for this. If you think that, I have an episode about Taylorism you should listen to. So just crosses my mind every time we touch on it. But what a thrilling...
A thrilling, exciting conclusion.
Yeah, exciting conclusion. You put our third co-host, Flapjack, to sleep with the conversation. He is passed out on the floor right now. It is only 81 degrees in here. So thank you for listening as we sit in the sauna. And we'll see you. We'll see you soon.
Well, that's it.
Yep, another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's hoppodcast.com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.